The Bhagavad Gita is like a scientific textbook of medicine. Just as when you read the Harrison's Principles of Internal Medicine, which is our Bible, which we study as we are going through medical school, any disease is there, it lists it in detail. Say if a patient has a pneumonia, it will talk about what pneumonia is, what are the causes of pneumonia, how can we diagnose it, how can we know the extent of the pneumonia, how much part of the lungs is involved. Then if not treated, what happens will be listed, what are the different medicines available, how to diagnose that the pneumonia has been cured, and then ultimately the complications if not properly treated. The Bhagavad Gita does the same with our personality. When we look at ourselves, we find certain deficiencies, certain problems, mental, spiritual, intellectual, not so much physical. The Bhagavad Gita mostly deals with the mind. And so we look within and the Bhagavad Gita tells us where we are. Suppose we are suffering from the disease of tamas, laziness, don't care, heedlessness, pramad. It will tell us, okay, these are the conditions which tell you that you are at this moment in tamas. And these are the reasons why you are in tamas. What is the extent of your ignorance? What is the extent of your negative thoughts? And what will happen if this tamas is not checked? So everything is listed very beautifully in the Bhagavad Gita, in the Yoga of Gunas, in the 14th chapter, 17th, 18th. And right now we are in the 17th chapter. And so if I'm in tamas, I know, okay, this is the diagnosis. Now what do I do? What happens if I don't treat it? How will this tamas affect my life? How will it bring me down? How will this negative tendency take me downward on the spiritual path? And then there is the treatment is given also in the Bhagavad Gita, how you can evolve from tamas to rajas, where rajas, tamas is laziness, rajas is activity, but it is a passionate activity, uncontrolled, sometimes with a hint of selfishness or arrogance or pride. And so the Gita says you are getting better, but you are still not at sattva. You are still not at the highest level. You still need to get better. You still need to take the Gita medicine longer. Just as a pneumonia is partially cured and the doctor says, well, you still need another 4 days of antibiotics. So the Gita says you need to take this Gita medicine longer till we get to sattva. Sattva is the world of purity and knowledge and right action. But spirituality says even when you are in sattva, you are not fully cured. You are much improved. You are almost normal. But there is a world beyond sattva. And that is the world of Om, the world of Brahman, the world of consciousness, where a person who is self-realized, who has become one with that reality, become one with that consciousness, and that's where the Gita finally takes us, even goes beyond sattva. It does not mean that his actions are not sattvic, but he's not bound by any actions. He does not do actions with an idea that, oh, if I practice sattva, I'll be a good person and I will help. Even that thought is not there. That is good, you know, if you are in a sattvic state, and that's what this chapter takes us to. But the highest state is the state of realization, where there is a spontaneous outpouring of love for entire humanity. And that's where the saints reside in. That's where Gurudev Swami Chinmayananda and Shankaracharya and Jesus and Buddha and Tukaram and Narasimha Mehta and Mirabai, all these great saints live in that state, which is even beyond sattva. And such a person is then not bound by any of the worldly conventions or rules because he or she has gone beyond this world. It does not mean that they don't function in this world. They actually function much more efficiently than you and I because they function from a higher level. So this 17th chapter, we're kind of almost two-thirds of the way through. And it talks about the three gunas, as we said, tamas, rajas, and sattva. and our daily activities, how we can see. So it talks about the tamasic, rajasic, and sattvic diet, which we have talked in much detail. I won't go into that. Little bit, sattvic is the fresh, pure food. Rajasic is the food that is very spicy, very rich, you know, full of calories. And then the sattvic food, which is pure. And then the tamasic food, which is stale, old food, which actually takes the mind downward, including, you know, a lot of the alcoholic drinks, drugs and all that. Then it talks about sattvic, rajasic and tamasic yajna, the activities. So we had studied a couple of weeks back, sattvic activities are done without right thing to be done, without any selfishness, without even worrying about the goal. Rajasic are activities done with showing off and with the pride and with selfishness, what can I get? And tamasic activities are activities done in the wrong way, without following the scriptures, without following any teachings. The person does whatever he feels like, and that is tamasic. Then we had talked about the tapa. Tapa is, as we had studied last week, is self-control. When you control yourself, not with the idea of depriving myself of the joys, but the idea that when I conserve my energies, we waste a lot of energy in unproductive activities, talking too much, working too much, doing things that we don't need to do, waste our time in unproductive activities. So when that energy is conserved, then that energy is used for my own betterment and for the betterment of society, for my own spiritual growth and to help society get better. So that is called tapa. Tapa does not mean sit in the forest on one leg. I mean, the rishis and some of them do that. But at you and I, we are not at this stage able to go sit in the forest, give up the family and sit in the Himalayas on one leg or stand. No, we can't do that. So we practice tapa in our day-to-day life, what Krishna has told us. And then he talked about tapa can be at three levels. We had studied the two last week. One is at the level of the body. What is tapas at the level of the body is worship of the gods and of the good people, the wise people, the gurus. And worship, again, we had studied, does not mean touching their feet or throwing flowers. That is good, but the true worship is following what the teacher has told us. And then we had talked about shaucham and arjavam, purity of mind and straightforwardness, and brahmacharya, ahimsa, self-control and non-violence, that is tapas of the body. We studied that last week. And then what is tapas of the speech? Speech that is sweet, speech that is honest, that is truthful, that does not create disturbance in others. And self-study, abhyas, practice, that is speech, that is tapas of speech. So we had studied tapas of the body, tapas of the speech. Now today we will talk about tapas of the mind. And then after that, Sri Krishna will tell us the three kinds of tapas, sattvic, rajasic and tamasic. So let us talk of tapas of the mind. It's verse number 16, chapter 17, verse number 16.
Manav prasada samyatvam. Maunam atma vinigraha. Bhava samshuddhirit yetat. Tapo mana samuchyate.
So what is manas tapa uchyate? What is said to be manasik tapas or tapas of the mind? Many people think, you know, just sit and control the mind and let the mind not go anywhere and do and not do anything. That is tapas or that is meditation. Well, that is not true meaning of that. We will talk about that and we'll do cover a little bit about meditation also. So, mana prasada means serenity and cheerfulness of the mind, where the mind is calm, where the mind is serene, where the mind is cheerful. Samyatvam is good-heartedness. To be a good-hearted person, soft, gentle, gentleness. Maunam is silence. Thank you. Maunam is silence. And Atma Vinigraha is self-control. And Bhava Samshuddhi, that is honesty of motive, honesty of action. Etat, all these, Tapo Manasam Uchyate. So if you are talking about, there are five things. Serenity of the mind, cheerfulness, good-hearted, soft, silent, control, and honesty of motive. So let us cover each one in some detail. These are all very important topics. So one should always be cheerful. One should always be peaceful, be calm. One should not be a source of disturbance for others. Not only that, but we find some people, they all the time so serious, as if the whole world's problems are on them. And then they will read something in the newspaper or the internet, you know, things are so bad. And when you sit in front of them, you get depressed. So you should be cheerful, be happy. You know, if you have read a joke, share it with somebody. Read the comics, talk to, make life joyful. It does not mean that you don't take life serious, but you don't have to be miserable. You don't have to be sad. You don't have to be stressed out. So being cheerful and at the same time being serene, being calm. You know, things will happen in the world. There are problems will arise. You know, if there is two people, there is bound to be fights, whether it's a husband and wife, brother and sister, co-workers. And same thing, two nations, two communities, the problems are always there. There will be problems in the home, problems in the city, problems in the county, state, country, the whole world. And instead of getting my mind stressed out about, worried about all this, just be calm and cheerful. And it's like it says, you know, there's a very famous saying, let me fix the things I can and accept the things I want, God, and give me the wisdom to know the difference. So what you can fix, fix. And what you can't fix, if somebody is shooting somebody in Iraq, what can I do about it? Nothing. All I can do is go pray and Bhagwan inko, you know, sadbuddhi do, give them some, you know, wisdom. There's no my point, my getting stressed and upset about something I have no control about. So cheerfulness and serenity of the mind is very, very important. It's one should make every effort to protect the mind, because the mind is a very delicate instrument. It's like a very delicate computer. You know, if you drop it, it will break and then it'll never be fixed. So the same, the mind can be very easily damaged. So protect it, take care of it, and love your mind and be protective of it. How does the mind's serenity get disturbed? So Swamiji in his commentary says very beautifully, Gurudev, that there are two ways the mind can get disturbed or leak out. One is from outside, you know, sense impulses come. I see hear something or hear something, or, you know, something happens and my mind gets disturbed. Oh, I'm so upset. I'm so stressed. He said this, she said that, this happened. Or from inside my desires and from inside the mind gets disturbed, you know, from inwardly, for no reason, your mind gets disturbed. And so that projects outward. When you are disturbed inside, then you yell at your spouse or your children or your employees. So the mind can be disturbed from outside or from inside. So that's why there are two words in our scriptures, Shama and Dama. Shama is control of the mind and Dama is control of the senses. So overindulging of senses, where unnecessarily I overindulge, or also controlling, let not the senses disturb my mind. Senses are like a river. In the Gita also, the Krishna says very beautifully. He says, just as an ocean is there and hundreds of rivers are constantly pouring water into the river, into the ocean, but the ocean remains the same. It does not get over flooded with all the rivers. It remains summer. It can absorb everything without overflowing its banks. A river, when too much water comes, can overflow its banks and flood, but the ocean never floods. So similarly, a wise person sees that all these impulses are coming into my mind, but his mind remains serene, does not overflow, does not get flooded, does not go out and disturb the surroundings. So outwardly there is control, Dama, that is the control of the senses, and Shama is control of the mind. he has enough mental self-control so that the mind again does not leak out into the world and create problems. So that is called serenity or cheerfulness of the mind. That is called mana prasada. Now what is samyatvam? Samyatvam is good-heartedness. Person has no enemies. Other people may consider him enemy. That person, he is my enemy number one. But this person says, I have no enemies. You can consider me as enemy, but I don't. I love everybody. That's what the saints say, you know, love even thy enemies. And that behavior is very soft, very gentle. You know, we find some people, they are so rough. They talk loudly, they walk loudly, they throw their slippers here and there. Even they chew their food loudly. And they're constantly disturbing the environment. You don't need to do that. You know, talk softly, talk words of love. And that can only happen when your heart is full of love for everybody. And that attitude that everything is one, oh Bhagavan, you are the one, you have created everything, everything is you, and me and I are, you and I are one, everything is that one. So how can I hate anybody? How can I? So that understanding, when it comes, then such a person alone can practice samyatvam. And total love, acceptance, forgiveness, even if somebody has wronged me, oh Lord, it's okay. I forgive him. Let you deal with him instead of me trying to fight back and take revenge and all. It does not mean you become a doormat where anybody and everybody can step on you. No, if there is something which you can fix, you fix it. But do not have the internal hatred, internal anger, or internal, because that is very disturbing to us. So that is samyatvam. The next is maunam. This is very important. We had covered that also, maunam, in the speech we had talked about. So here, you're talking about maunam of the mind, silence of the mind. See, people think silence means shouldn't talk. And in fact, there was a couple who the guru had told them, you know, you should practice silence at least sometime during the day. So they said, okay, from now on, we'll practice, you know, Saturday morning for 3 hours, we won't speak. So they would not talk. But what they would do, they would write notes, furiously writing long, lengthy notes, hand it to him, and then he writes the length. So then the guru again came back. So he saw all these papers. He said, what are you guys doing? He said, we are practicing silence. He said, what kind of silence? You're just wasting stationery. You know, when you're furiously writing notes to each other, that is not silence. You know, one-page note, your mind is more, he says, better talk, you know, rather than doing that. So the practice of silence starts at the mental level. The mind has to be peaceful. Mind has to be calm. Serenity of the mind. Then whether you speak or not, the mind does not get disturbed. It's not that one should not speak. But yeah, some people do that. That they will say, okay, 1 hour on Thursday morning, I won't speak at all. I'll meditate. And if you can do that, that's good. But it should not be at the... My mind is so agitated and running and stressed, but I won't speak. No. And I have to say something, and they wait an hour and then they blurt out, you know, 5 minutes or 10 minutes of yelling at some. No, not like that. The mind is peaceful, and if I have to speak something, as we said, speak limited, speak softly, speak with love, you know, as we said, priya hitam, you know, what is beneficial to the other person. There is a very beautiful book, Hymn to Sri Dakshinamurti. I would recommend this. If anybody in one small 10 verses has the entire essence of Vedanta, this is my most favorite book. It's only $5. I would recommend everybody read it, because it, in 10 verses, Bhagavan Shankaracharya, I mean, he's a master, my pranams to him. In 10 verses, he has done a total summary of the entire Vedanta, of how to live the life. It's the most beautiful text. I actually have memorized all the 10 verses and the uska jo prologue hota na, the introductory dhyanam. I memorized all that. And it's such a beautiful text. And in that, there is a story about these four old rishis, the Sanat Kumaras. They were son of Brahmaji. And they had studied a lot. They had read all the books and they had profound knowledge. but they didn't have the peace. See, sometimes when you read too much, and then sometimes it is becomes very difficult to internalize the knowledge. And so they knew a lot. They were very intelligent, but they had not encountered that final peace. And that sometimes can only come in the presence of an enlightened guru, a presence of a wise guru. So they go in search of a guru, because their father, Brahmaji, could have given them the knowledge, but he was too busy creating. He said, look, I don't have time. And plus, usually children will never learn from the father. If the father says something, it is useless. It has to be an outside guru who will teach. So they go looking for a guru, and they had become very old by then, you know, and they were getting impatient because time is passing. And so they go under this tree, they go to this, come down the mountain, and under this tree there is sitting this young man, and face was serene, calm, cheerful, sitting with extreme peace and silence. And they said, who is this young man? It was actually Lord Shiva himself, who manifests as Dakshinamurti. Dakshinamurti, Dakshina means south. South means is considered the zone of ignorance. So he is living in the north, facing south means he is wisdom itself. And so Lord, that's what happens when our desire to know is strong. The Lord himself appears and makes the knowledge clear. And it has happened to me many times. If there is something that is bothering me or something that I'm worried or not sure about, next day, when I open up a book, whether it's Gita or some commentary on Gita or some Upanishad, somewhere the answer comes exactly what. And I'm like, how did this happen to me today also? There was some instance I was perturbed about, and I opened that commentary on the Gita, and exactly the same words are addressed. So the Lord does that. When your desire is true, he will himself appear in some form or the other, as a guru, as a book, as a teaching. And so these four sages come and they find this young man and they sit in front of him. And they don't speak anything and he doesn't speak anything. His eyes are closed. He opens his eyes, he looks at them, doesn't speak a word. And there is a very beautiful verse in this. It says, Chitram Vatataror Mule Vridha Shishya Gurur Yuva Gurostu Monam Vyakhyanam Shishyastu Chinna Samshayaha. It says, it's a vichitram, it's a strange thing. What? The student are old and the teacher is young. It's usually the other way around. But there is a young man sitting there and there are four old students. And how does he teach? Mauna vyakhyanam. He speaks in silence. Dakshinamurti just looked at them in silence and all their doubts were answered. And they got that total peace that they had been looking for, that they had years of study, could not solve what that one glance of that guru did it. And then it says in there, chin mudra. Dakshinamurti teaches with the chin mudra. Chin mudra I have addressed before, but a lot of new people. So because we always do that, right? When you do meditation, you put your finger like that. So what is the significance? Why is chin mudra? Chin also means chit, means knowledge or consciousness. Mudra means posture. So the posture of knowledge. So why this is important is Swami Chinmayananda at another place had given an explanation for that. He said this finger is ego because this is a pointer, right? This finger is called the pointer. So I point you, I don't like you, you. So what does he mean? You means you are separate from me. So when you point at somebody, that's why they say it is rude to point. So when you point, that means this finger represents ego. It means I and you. You know, I don't like you, I like. So this finger represents ego and the thumb represents God or Brahman. Because without the thumb, suppose my thumb is cut off, my hand is useless, right? I cannot hold a pen, I cannot paint, I cannot use a screwdriver. I cannot drive a car, I cannot hold the steer. There's nothing I can do if my thumb is cut. So the thumb represents God, just as without God's presence, our body, mind and intellect are useless if Om or consciousness is not in me. So when the thumb is missing, the whole hand is useless. So this ego, when it connects to God, when it connects to Brahman, right? So it is now when in the chin mudra, the ego is connected to God. And what it is doing, it is separating from the other three fingers. Right? So the three fingers represent the three gunas, sattva, rajas and tamas, also represent the three states of time, past, present, future, also represent body, mind, intellect. So when this ego, which is attached to the body, mind and intellect, and depending on the body, it separates from that. Separates does not mean that it gives up the body, mind and intellect, or but gives up the identification, gives up attachment, and gives up even the attachment to sattva, rajas and tamas, and holds on to God. Then what happens? It forms a circle, a perfect circle, right? And a circle is considered as infinity, because a circle has no beginning, no end. Where does a circle begin? Where does it end? No, it goes round and round. So that ego, when it gives up the attachment to the worldly things and holds on to God, it becomes infinite. So that is why the Chin Mudra is so important. So Dakshinamurti, in his this beautiful text, teaches through silence. He just shows the Chin Mudra, and with the mind he is able to communicate. So that is the benefit of silence, that through silence sometimes you can communicate a lot more than even by speaking, or maybe using a few choice words. So that's why Maunam is also considered a tapas of the mind. And the next one is self-control. Now self-control is a word that we all dislike. Why? Why should I control myself? This is a free country. We live in America. Even kids, even five-year-old kids, you know, you tell them you should not. I live in a free country in the United States of America. I'm free to do what I want. I have freedom. And it starts from 5 and goes up to 85. You know, everybody, nobody likes self-control. The moment you say, you should control yourself, why? Because God has made these eyes and the senses to enjoy. And this whole world is there for my enjoyment. Why should I control myself? Why? And, you know, people are always, nobody likes to control themselves. But self-control does not mean denial. Does not mean that you don't, you know, hear no evil, see no evil, speak no evil, you know, like, or I should not see, hear, smell, taste, touch anything. I should not eat, drink. No, what it means is living a life of moderation and conserving, again, as we said, conserving your energy and following the rules of conduct, because then only you can make your life beneficial. If you are all the time indulging and doing things that are wrong or unethical, you'll create problems in the world. But if I live a life of moderation, self-control, follow the rules, then my actions are beneficial to me and beneficial to society. Like DMV, you know, now there are rules made for cars. You can only, you know, you have to stop at a stop sign. You have to drive the speed limit. If I don't, then, you know, I'll be a danger to myself and a danger to the others. So rules are meant to be for the benefit of everybody and for the benefit of society. Talking about driving, this couple had bought this brand new Porsche. You know, it was the delight of their eyes, and they both loved it. And the husband says, I'm going to take it for a test drive. And husband had the habit of driving a little fast. And so after about 15, 20 minutes, he calls the wife. He says, honey, I have some good news and I have some bad news. So she says, look, I've had enough bad news for the day. You know, one child got into trouble at school. Another one is sick. Another one is misbehaving. I don't want any more bad news. Just give me the good news. So he said, honey, all the airbags work. So the rules are meant for life to function properly. But then self-control should not become a strain. You know, some people, their mind is so running, and so stressed. But they won't, you know, they say, oh, I have to self-control. So they won't say anything, they won't do anything. And then 2 hours later, they say, give me a cup of coffee. He said, you just had breakfast. An hour later, you want coffee again. No, my mind is stressed. I'm so tense. No, mind should be samyatvam, should be serene, should be cheerful. And it starts with the calmness of the mind. So make an effort. And for that, puja is very important. Worshipping the Lord, and some amount of meditation, practice some meditation every day. So these two things, and also contact with the gurus and with the right knowledge, these things help to make the mind quiet. That's why when you get out of your puja room, of your prayer room, and you, if you have spent a few minutes with the Lord, your mind is more peaceful. And same thing happens after meditation. If you have learned properly to meditate, and your mind is more quiet. So that is called self-control. Then is bhava samshuddhihi, honesty of motive. And the motive is the number one thing which determines whether your action is good or bad. It's not what you do. It is the motive that's very important. And we have, you know, talked about that innumerable times. A surgeon, you know, cutting somebody's stomach, and then if the person doesn't survive, he tried his best. His motive was good. But if a criminal is cutting somebody's stomach and he doesn't survive, the same action done by two different people, one goes to jail, another one you say, well, you know, patient was too sick, he was bleeding, and so he tried his best. So the motive is very important. It may not be so much in the court of law. You know, suppose you do something wrong, even if your motive was good, you may be punished. But in the God's court, if your motive is good, if you intend to do good, if your intentions were pure, even if something happened that inadvertently you didn't plan and something happened, but he understands. It is the purity of motive and the purity of the thoughts. Are my thoughts pure? Are my thoughts loving? Are my thoughts compassionate? But how about if negative thoughts come? Negative thoughts come or negative desires come. They say, just give them to the Lord. If I'm getting angry at somebody or getting some, rude thoughts or very hateful thoughts or very selfish thoughts, dedicated to Bhagavan, I know these bad thoughts are coming, but I give them to you. You are the one who is all love and you take care of this thought. Just surrender to the Lord and whoever the God is, and just say, okay, that is your job. You please take care of this thought. I know this thought is not good, or I know this desire is not good. Sometimes you get wrong kind of desires. Just say, Lord, I have this desire. If it's in my prarabdh, if it is good for me, let it happen. If it is bad for me, you take care of that. So surrendering to the Lord and constantly remembering is a very beautiful way of purifying your mind and making your motives pure. That's why the Bhagavad Gita is called a book of desire management. It has many other, like we said, it is a book of medicine, textbook of medicine, but also is a book of desire management. How do I manage my desires? Because that is what disturbs us, raga and dvesha. Raga means I like, dvesha means I dislike. So what happens is that in life, we are always met with things we like and things we dislike. It's nobody has everything perfect. You know, kabhi kisi ko mukammal jahan nahi milta. You've heard that from, Rao Jan. Nobody's life is perfect. You will sometimes get things you like. Sometimes you will get things we dislike. And we develop raga. We develop attachment to things we like. And hatred, dvesha, for things we don't like. Why does this thing always come? Or why do this person always show up in front of me? So raga and dvesha, likes and dislikes, desire and hatred, attachment and hatred, creates this negative disturbance in my mind. And so we are always oscillating between raga and dvesha, like and dislike, hatred and attachment. And Sri Krishna says it very beautifully. He says in the third chapter, he says, Tayorna Vasham Agachet, do not come under the control. Because these two things, raga and dvesha, likes and dislikes, are our enemies. Krishna says they are a person's enemies because they sway you. One time happy, one time unhappy. I got something I liked. Remain calm. Keep your mind sama. That's why samadhan is one of the very important qualities. And it says keep your mind calm. Keep your mind equanimous. Life will give us. Nobody is all the time going. Sometimes there will be joy. Remember, if there is joy, don't get over happy, because next moment you might get sorrow. And if it happens, don't get over depressed Watch it. Be a witness. Observe the mind and see what is the mind doing. And when this results come, develop a prasad buddhi. What is a prasad buddhi? Like when I go to temple, or when I, you know, here in the temple, or when you go to the church, the priest or the pujari gives you some prasad, right? Some. Now you don't say, I like this prasad, I don't like this prasad. Whatever it is has been blessed by the Lord. I take it and I accept it cheerfully, because it's the Lord Himself who is giving it to me. But if you say, why did I get this, you know, prasad? I don't like, you know, this, give me that. No, nobody does that. So similarly in life, when these situations happen, accept them as prasad buddhi. Oh Lord, it was my own karmas because of which I got something I disliked, or it was my own karmas, I got something which I liked. I was successful in one, I failed in other. But these are all what I deserve. This is my prasad. This is from blessings from the Lord. And cheerfully accept it. And what will happen is that your mind will become calmer. When situations are not very compatible or very good, our mind gets disturbed. But when you say, it is my prarabdha, it is my karmas, and it is the Lord's grace because of which I am here, or because of which I am getting this. Or sometimes some people take this as an opportunity to improve. Suppose I get something bad happen, or somebody says something. You look at it as, this is my opportunity to improve. The Lord is sending me a message. And actually that is true. If something bad happens, take it that it is an alarm clock. The Lord is waking me up. And if you don't learn, the lesson will be repeated. I think I had said that in my Thursday class. If you do not learn, the lesson will be repeated. It's like in India. Here they don't do that. But if you don't study the fourth grade well, they make you repeat it, right? They don't automatically promote you to fifth and sixth. In this country, they do that. But in India, they don't. They say you have to again repeat fourth grade till you are able to pass it. So similarly, when these problems come, they are coming for a reason, because God is wanting to teach me a lesson. I need to learn. And if I don't learn from that and don't change my behavior, the lesson will be repeated. So take this adversity as an opportunity to improve, as an opportunity to grow, as an opportunity to evolve, as an opportunity to be a better person. And that is what this prasad buddhi is called, and that is how you handle raga and dvesha. Then one of the most powerful spiritual techniques is mind observation. I remember Swami Ishwarananda, when he was going to India, it was in the year 2000, I think he was going to go teach the course for 2.5 years, and that was his last visit to Bakersfield. And I was driving him to the airport. And I have this habit when I'm driving with Swamijis and all, I try to always ask them something or learn something. Instead of all the time just talking about, you know, take this opportunity when you have the master with you, why not learn? So I told Swamiji, I said, Swamiji, now you're going to India. I don't know when I'll see you again. Do you have some word of advice for me? You know, some word of wisdom. So this is what he said. He said, always observe your mind. Watch your mind. That is the most powerful spiritual technique. And we all need to start practicing that. And what is my mind doing at this moment? Maybe some of you are thinking, you know, it's a boring lecture. I should be watching football. The playoffs will be starting at 12:30. You know, I know. And some of you may be thinking, I'm falling asleep. But anyway, so whatever your mind is doing, observe it. And watch it and say, what is my mind doing at this moment? And if it is happy, okay, my mind is happy. You don't say, I am happy. My mind is happy. And then if the mind is sad, my mind is sad. I am not sad, because I am not the mind. I am the owner of the mind. If my mind is angry, why is the mind angry? Okay, I watch it and analyze it. Don't become caught in the anger. Don't become caught in the sadness. Don't even become caught in the happiness. Be a witness to all. And actually, I was reading a commentary on this Gita, and it's the Swami says, he says, these Mahatmas in the Himalayas, they stay for years alone. Now, what is their entertainment? For you and me, if we go stay for one day, second day we'll say, "Arey, it's so boring here. There's no TV, there's no internet, no cell phone, no computer. How can I survive here 2 days? Forget about, you know, 2 years or 10 years or 20 years. So what is their entertainment? They watch the mind. And the mind provides you endless entertainment. If you watch the mind, you know, oh, it does all kind of fanciful things and creates, kya bolte, khayali pulao, you know, creates all these beautiful worldly, you know, all these dreams and all this. So learn to observe the mind. The moment you learn to observe the mind, and that's what we practice even in meditation, when those of us who meditate, you watch the mind, then immediately the mind becomes a source of entertainment instead of a source of disturbance. And then anything that you watch from a distance, then you are not involved. It's like you're watching from the balcony and there is the, you know, Macy's Thanksgiving Day parade going on. And suppose you are not involved in that, you don't have a son or daughter in the parade, then you watch the parade and say, okay, you know, the parade is going and, you know, it's... But if I have a float in there or if I have a child, then I want to know, is my float better than others? You know, then I get involved. Oh, is it everything going well? Not. But if I just watch it, I can enjoy that. So that's what they say, enjoy your mind, observe your mind. And so all these, when you practice, it seems like a lot, but this is tapas of the mind. And they all are connected. You know, when you are serene, when you are good-hearted, then automatically your mind is peaceful, automatically it is controlled, automatically your motives are honest, your desires are reduced. So that's why Krishna gives us all these together, because they are all connected. It's a very, very powerful verse, and this is something we should memorize and practice this. Practice this. Because ultimately everything comes to the mind. Even if your mind is good, your speech will be good, your actions will be good. So that's why tapas of the body was given first, and then speech, and then the mind, because the mind is the most important. Everything starts from the mind. Any questions? Any comments?
A practical technique on observing mind.
I think when thoughts arise, you're sitting alone, right, doing nothing, and the thought arises. Especially we teach that in meditation, but you can also do it. Start watching. Distance yourself from the mind. And say, don't say, I am angry, but say, my mind is angry. Don't say, I am upset, my mind is upset. Don't say, I am happy, my mind is happy. Get in the habit of saying that. And then watching and say, okay, now I am watching my mind. And what is it doing? And it's thinking about the insult. You know, yesterday somebody insulted me and I'm feeling so sad about it. Or yesterday, you know, somebody praised me, I'm feeling so happy about it. But it is my mind that is doing it. It is the thoughts. So become a witness of the thoughts. The example they give is like the river, you know, the Kern River. It flows very fast. Now, if you are in the Kern River, you will be washed and, you know, you won't survive. But if you're standing on the banks and the river, the faster it goes, the more you can enjoy the river. You can watch it. Ah, the beautiful river. So similarly, practice observing the mind. Distance yourself from the mind and tell yourself that I am not the mind, but I am the owner of the mind. I am the witness of the mind. So develop this sakshi bhav, and you can slowly develop that with practice. Especially in when you sit for meditation, that's when at least I find my mind runs the most. And so come in the now. At this moment, what am I doing? I am meditating. And these thoughts, they are arising in my mind. They are unnecessary thoughts. You know, I'm thinking about the past, what somebody said, or future. What am I going to do after meditation? Where am I going to go? I don't need to right now. Right now, I'm in the presence of the Lord. I am in meditation. So when you practice in meditation, focusing on the now, on the Lord within, and ignoring the thoughts. If a negative thought comes, I ignore it. If a positive thought comes, I still ignore it. At this moment, it's not important. So that practice in meditation, you carry throughout the day. So that's how. So learn to observe and watch and witness rather than be involved. Does that answer your question? But really, regular meditation helps. I find that if after meditation you can develop that ability to watch the mind. It's slow. It's a slow process. It's slowly, but it's very powerful. It's the most powerful technique for mind control.
So replacing that thought is initial, and then gradually withdraw from that thing. That helps sometimes.
Yes, that's a very good point. Yeah, replace the name of God if there's a disturbing thought, right? And so remembering the Lord is always helps. Never, it can never go wrong with that.
You want to do this.
Right.
The desire management won't come.
Yeah, I was going to address it in the next verse. But desire...
Without desire, you don't want to achieve anything. You need, I want to have a nice house.
Right.
I have that desire, so I'm going to work for it, right? Like that. How do you control that management?
Well, first of all, you have to distinguish between right and wrong desires, obviously. You know, if you want to desire to steal your neighbor's car, now that's not a good desire. So you have to distinguish. But I think what they mean is that, yeah, you need to have things and, you know, for your, well, taking care of yourself and your family and all. But what happens is, say I work with a particular desire. Okay, I go to work and say, you know, I'm working because I want this or that. Then when I don't get it, then I become disappointed. When I get it, I become elated. Then I develop greed, more, I want more and more. And I develop aversion, or I develop anger towards those who are in the middle of my desire as an obstacle to my desire. But if I do something that it is the right thing to do, to be done, at this moment, wherever I am, this is the right thing I have to do. And when I do the right thing, which is my duty, and at that moment, I don't worry about the results, about what I'm going to get, the fruit. I don't have the desire to get something. I do what is right. Then the results will take care of itself. If I work hard, I will get money. I will get a house if I do the right thing. But while working, I'm not doing it for that purpose, that by doing this, I will get a house. I do the right thing, and then it's like a doctor, you know, when he's seeing patients. If he's seeing them with the idea that how much money am I going to make, then obviously his whole view will be colored by that. But if he says, my job is to treat my patients well, smile, and automatically the money will come. The patients will send more patients, and, you know, he'll get busier. And it's the same thing in any field. So when you're working with a particular desire or goal in mind, then your activities can become selfish, can become, you know, greedy. But if I'm doing what is the right thing to do, then such a person goes beyond desire, does what is right, whatever the Lord has placed in front of me, wherever he has placed me, I do my best and don't worry. So that is called desire management. It does not mean that you don't have objects, but you don't work for a particular object. You do whatever is the right at this moment. But that we'll address a little more in the next word. Hanji.
Simple level.
Right, very true. Every action, am I doing it tamasic, rajasic, or sattvic? Yeah, that's very important. Thank you. Om sarve bhavantu sukhinah, sarve santu niramayah, sarve bhadrani pasyantu, ma kaschid dukha bhavave. Om shanti shanti shantihi. Hari Om, Shri Gurubhyo Namaha. Hari Om. Thank you very much.